Hello, my name is Andreina.
And my name is Gabriela, and this is Wicks and Candles,
a podcast about two sisters and their obsession with period film.
Join us on a trip through palaces and manors, balls and tea parties, and a lot of dresses, carriages, and of course, wicks and candles.
In this episode, A Royal Affair. So, Gabby, the movie we are discussing today has been on our long list of movies to discuss since we started this podcast, and the day is finally here. I had seen this movie before, and rewatching it now was a very good reminder of why we wanted to discuss it for so long. It's a very classic period film.
Definitely. And this is only one of the many reasons why we took this film on our list. We've really been wanting to discuss it for such a long time.
Yeah, and today's the day, finally. So, Gabby, can you please give us some facts about the movie?
Sure, Nene, with pleasure. A Royal Affair is a Danish film from 2012 that tells the story of King Christian VII of Denmark, who was mentally ill, and the romance between his wife, Queen Caroline Matilda, and his physician, Johann Friedrich Struensee. It was directed by Nikolai Arcel, and it stars Mads Mikkelsen as Struensee, Alicia Vikander as Queen Caroline Matilda, and Mikkel Fjelsgaard as King Christian. The list of accolades on this film is rather short, but is full of heavyweight names in the world of the awards. It was nominated for both the Oscars and the Golden Globes on the category of Best Foreign Language Film. And most importantly, the film won Best Script and Best Actor, awarded to Mikkel Fjelsgaard for his role as King Christian in the 62nd edition of the Berlinale, the Berlin Film Festival. And I have some interesting trivia on this, Nene.
Okay.
Especially regarding Mikkel as King Christian. The actor, the Danish actor Mikkel Fjelsgaard, acted on this film, being his first ever feature film role ever. He was still attending theater school at the time he was casted for this film.
Wow.
So him being awarded the best actor in this very renowned film festival must have been a huge milestone for this actor, certainly. Also interesting, Alicia Vikander is a Swedish actress, and she had to learn Danish for her role. And she spent 2 months learning Danish in Copenhagen, and still by the time she got informed, she was informed that she got the role, and the director told her, "You got the role." She didn't really understand what he was saying, so she was just like saying, "Okay." But she made a face where he was certain, it was clear for him that she didn't really get what he said, so he had to tell her again in English, "You have the part."
Wow.
Yes. And something that I found also interesting, a little giggle that gave me a little giggle while watching the an interview with the cast and crew, the actress Trine Dyrenholm, who plays the regent queen, like the stepmother of Christian, when she was asked what was her motivation to take on this role for this film, she said, "I have been dreaming for long to be in a film with, in a period film with big costumes and a lot of wicks and candles." And I thought, this, this is just a pearl for us to hear this. So obviously there are many, many, many people in this world who also dream of wicks and candles and I found it just so suitable for our podcast. So yes, that was the most important information on the film. And I'm sure we will certainly go through other pieces of the production and also some of the cast names throughout our conversation.
Okay.
So Nene, would you like to continue with a short summary of the story?
Yes, of course, Gabby. Thank you very much for the information about the movie and those little bits of trivia. They are always so interesting. The year is 1766, and young progressive art-loving princess Caroline Matilda of Great Britain travels to Denmark to meet her husband, King Christian VII. After a brief introduction, Caroline quickly realizes that the king is nothing like she could have imagined. He humiliates her publicly and treats her with contempt from the start. The king is clearly suffering from psychological distress, and the palace decides to hire a new physician to treat him. The man is Johann Friedrich Struensee, a physician and thinker who is deeply influenced by the ideas of the Enlightenment. Slowly, Struensee's influence on Christians will be total, helping him bring enormous progress to the kingdom for a brief period of time. At the same time, Caroline and Struensee fall into a love affair which will endanger Caroline and Struensee's ideas of a bright new world. Brought to life in sumptuous period film detail, A Royal Affair tells a story in which love, politics, ideas, and history intersect in astonishing and heartbreaking fashion.
Very well, Nelly.
There we go. Okay, so that's my little summary of the plot, and now to the historical context, which is something that we have been trying to do since we started season 4, just so that we can place the events of the film in a little bit better in time and space. So here you go. So the historical context of the movie is the arrival of the Enlightenment ideas in Denmark in the second half of the 18th century. As many of you probably know already, the Enlightenment is also called the Age of Reason, and its central ideas were expressed and expounded by a group of French philosophers, including its main representative, Voltaire, but also the Swiss writer Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Among the many preoccupations of this intellectual movement is the role of the individual within society, as well as the advancement of science and knowledge and its role in improving life for human beings in society. More specifically, the movie covers the reign of Christian VII of Denmark, who ascended to the throne at 17 and married his cousin, Caroline Mathilde, when she was just 15. It is clear that Christian suffered from mental illness most of his life, and his marriage to Caroline was a very unhappy one. During his reign, he was mostly a nominally king, which means that the council and later Struensee were the actual de facto rulers of the country. So that's a little bit of the historical context of the movie. And again, it informs a lot of the events that we see in the story.
Thank you, Nini. Thank you for that, for framing the context, which will certainly help us throughout our conversation, especially with our first topic of discussion. I think I also had watched the film a long time ago, and rewatching it was also very refreshing, and I realized how many similarities there are in such stories from the past with our current contemporary history in society. And I thought it would be good, we were preparing for a podcast, we also thought it would be good to touch on this. We both agreed on the heaviness of the events that were portrayed in the film, and you came up with a very suitable and fitting terminology for this. You named it the pain of history. So, Nene, in your eyes, what do you think about the story portrayed in this feature film, which is a very important and pivotal element in the history of Denmark as a nation, in regards of the pain of history, how hard it is for nations to be born and forge progress? How do you see this? And specifically, how do you take this on the events shown in this film?
Yeah. Thank you, Gabi. Thank you for that question. Yeah, when we were trying to come up with the topics to discuss, this was the first one that kind of came to mind. This is a movie that shows a very specific historical moment in the history of Denmark, one that we obviously are not familiar with. This is our first Danish film in the podcast. And it struck me, you know, the story is complex, is compelling, and is profoundly sad, but with a little silver lining in the end. And we always say, please watch the movie before you listen to the podcast, because there will be spoilers. And the expression, the pain of history, kind of kept repeating in my mind as I was watching, because essentially it tells the story of this kingdom that was still very much, you know, stuck in the past. In fact, Caroline at some point, she says that it was still in the Middle Ages, in terms of ideas and progress and the structure of society, in terms of, you know, the aristocracy and then the peasants and the serfs, right? In fact, this is a term that's used throughout the movie, serfdom. It was still in place in Denmark, and we're talking about 1766, right? So what we come to understand in the movie is that Caroline, even from a very young age, had already very progressive ideas about society, about the improvement of the human being. She was reading Rousseau. In fact, when she arrives at court, a number of her books are returned to England because they're banned in Denmark. So that's the first indication that the place she has come from is at a different place ideologically than Denmark, right? So that's the first indication that this country is in a different moment historically. So when Struse, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but I'm trying. When he comes in as a physician for the king, he brings with him all of these ideas. And little by little, through influence and through machinations, different manipulations of the palace intrigue, they managed to implement a number of changes in society, little by little, including, you know, eliminating serfdom. I think one of the laws that they managed to pass is making torture illegal, and I don't remember other.
Yeah, they eliminated censorship.
They eliminated censorship, of censorship, the press. Yeah,
of the press, and they created orphanage.
They created orphanage, and also I think they reduced the working hours for the people working in the fields, for the farmers and peasants, So as soon as, you know, Struensee was able to come in and start influencing the king, which we will touch at different points, it happens gradually. They are able to establish this, all of these changes, but very quickly we can see how the structures in place, specifically the council, who was the de facto ruler of the kingdom, because Christian was not he was not mentally able to actually govern, really pushed back against all of these things. And as soon as they were able to fight against this and revert to previous laws, they did it. So that's what that's why it made me think of, you know, progress is such a hard battle. It's obviously never easy. It takes many lives. It takes decades and generations to be able to move forward. And it's never guaranteed. It can always it can always be taken
swing
away.
Back.
Yeah, you can always move back. And this movie is kind of like, it really shakes you that way. It really shows you how this country had to really fight for these ideals. And it was not an easy fight. What do you think?
Nene, I find it very fascinating. And as I said in my introduction to the question, there is a pattern that keeps repeating throughout the history of civilization, of humanity.
Yeah.
The pendulum, what we always see, this pendulum that a nation, a country can swing forward, and go into a reach of progress and enjoy very advanced ideas and concepts and principles, and then swing back. It's a natural phenomenon throughout history. Yeah, that everything goes two steps forward, one step back, and this was another piece of history that that confirms this pendulum phenomenon of the history of humanity. And it is painful, and it is it makes us reflect so much on what is at stake when the people are trying to forge progress. Yeah, what does it really take for a society to push something forward to the benefit of the majority? And what I found interesting was that first I wasn't aware of the timing of this happening. This was way before the French Revolution.
Yep.
So of course the ideas were there.
Yep.
The ideas were there, and they were obviously spreading throughout Europe. Still the most remarkable token out of this chapter in Danish history was that they still managed to implement lots of these very avant-garde ideas, even though it was just for a short time, but they did manage to implement them way before there were really spread for real throughout Europe. Yeah. So this is really remarkable.
Yeah.
And how fragile it is! How fragile it is to keep something alive that you have fought for, and this is why maybe it goes back and forth always. Yeah,
yeah. I think if I remember the other thing was during the movie there's a smallpox.
Yes.
How do you call that? Epidemic.
Epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And. Strunze, who's a physician but also a man of the Enlightenment, he says, "I know of a solution. We can try inoculation." And the king and Caroline had already had a baby. They had a baby very soon after they married, after she arrived. And they agreed, actually, to let the baby be vaccinated, inoculated. Yeah, and it was successful. And little by little, they manage to, you know, to do a vaccination campaign, because there was this epidemic happening and many people have died, and by the time that the physician had a great influence, had kind of like control of the government, they were able to do even a vaccination campaign and save many lives.
Yeah, absolutely. This was also, and this is again something that if we see it today, it's not that easy to make clear when a good idea is a good idea. Oh. It's not easy to convince people that a good idea is a good idea.
Gabby.
You know, and this is why I say it's so relevant today, and not just like, for example, in the vaccination, we just have a huge pandemic behind us, and it was not easy to convince. And this may sound frugal, but more than 200 years pass and the topic is still relevant. This is why I said this is something that fascinates us. And for example, abolition of serfdom, we can duplicate this or replicate this to other topics that are relevant in our society today. Rights for minorities, freedom of speech, it's not something that it can be taken for granted.
Never be taken for granted. And especially since if we look around the world right now, you know, any of these things are happening at least in one place or another around the globe. Mm-hmm. A place where people where there's censorship, a place where people don't believe in vaccinations, a place where, you know, women are still treated like second-class citizens, a place where workers are treated like actual slaves, and so on. So
more
you can
slaves.
Look around yes. anywhere on earth right now and you will find one of these things. So obviously it's so fragile. But what you just said is so interesting, how hard it is to convince people that a good idea is a good idea. And of course, the Enlightenment was about science. And I was just doing a quick research, just so briefly, just looking around and, you know, where do historians say Enlightenment started? And actually, they make it really long. You know, it's a period that starts at the end of the 17th century, so around 1685. And it goes kind of all the way to very early 19th century. So essentially, the whole 18th century is considered the age of reason. And one of the main core elements of it is that the progress made by scientists in natural science. So as the discoveries in natural science advance, obviously, philosophers and thinkers start putting two things together. Like, what does this mean? As the more we understand about the world, the natural world, the less religion seems like a like a logical, theory or concept. So, but also the other thing is what you just said, that that pendulum that happens, right, which very clearly happened in Denmark, and we haven't explained exactly how it happened. So what happened in the movie is that the king ascends to the throne very young, 17-year-old, but he very quickly falls ill. Like, he seems to be I think historians have tried to diagnose him. Some say that he might have schizophrenia, but obviously it's very difficult to determine what he was suffering from. But obviously he was not somebody who was able to govern, or if he was, he was completely infantilized by the council that he worked with. So he was not in any position to actually govern at all. He was just like a little puppet signing, or a little kid, not even a puppet, like a little kid signing decrees. That's all he had. He will sit in the the council meetings, and they will pass this and that, and they will just give him the papers to sign and say, "Oh, well, this one is too long, you don't need to read," and he will just sign. The performance of this young actor as King Christian is absolutely moving and absolutely sad. this was a very ill, this was a person who was very ill, very unhappy. And he was used by almost everybody around him. So what happened is he gets married to this beautiful woman who actually was well-read, a pianist, love art, was influenced by the Enlightenment ideas, even by age 15, 16. And when the physician, Sun Tzu, comes in, they fall in love. And they fall in love through their ideas. Which is a topic, yes. Which is a topic that we love in this podcast. they fall in love through their minds, right? When she realizes, oh, this is a man of reason. And her husband is the actual opposite. You can say he had no reason. He was mentally ill. Quite painful, right?
Yes.
So they realize, and this is an important topic as well, because they realize they can start to influence the politics of the country to start to implement the Enlightenment ideas through Christian, because he was so easy to manipulate, right? So they start to, you know, they fall in love, they have an affair, and they have a parallel project, which is to start to govern, implement all these ideas through the king, by manipulating the king. But, you know, at the end of this were good things.
It were good things. I was just about to say that the...
But.
yes, that the but. yeah, that... At least in the film, even though it is at least as historians document this, that he was officially ill and they still confirm this until today. Mm. At least in the film, I had the impression that Christian, that he left it open for me as a viewer, whether Christian was really ill or just really, pushed down or mistreated because he was eccentric and because he had a very effervescent personality and was just not suitable for the time and for his position. Then maybe he was just too exotic for a king.
Too eccentric?
Too eccentric for a king. That's how I took it, because he had a lot of moments of clarity and where he definitely also saw the good in the ideas that Strunze and Caroling were given to him, you know, because they did meet together. They didn't do this like behind closed walls and just let him sign a paper. They really met. You see few scenes throughout the film where the three of them and a couple of close friends sit down together and discuss the ideas and really make it clear. And you see Christian in that moment understanding the goal of each idea and progress. And yes, of course, they manipulated him in a way, but not really to take advantage of him, but they put the idea on the foreground. It was like, okay, if we will need his signature and all of this, but we won't do it. We won't take him as a puppet, as a marionette, but we will take him as an ally. We will make him an ally of our mission.
Wow!
And that I found very good in the film. Up until the moment, of course, where Strunze gets too greedy and he swings way to the extreme of, okay, if I have come so far and it has been so successful so far, I might even try to go further, which, of course, caused him to, he got too greedy and he made himself...
very vulnerable. Yeah. You know what? You are right. It's true that they didn't do anything behind his back. However, they were having an affair.
Yes, in that regard.
in that regard. Yeah, so it's quite
questionable.
Well, no, definitely questionable, but it's also complicated because they needed him to pass these ideas to make them. They needed him, and I don't think they, in the movie anyway, that they had any pleasure in manipulating him. They really thought these are the ideas that we, that will benefit our nation. And, let's work together. And it's true. There's a number of scenes where they all working together, including the king.
Yes.
There are others where it's a little less clear, right? It's always like, when they say, you love acting, because he did love acting and he loved Shakespeare. And that's the way Strunze got to him, actually, by reciting Shakespeare back and forth with each other. This is going to be, and they tell him, this is going to be just like acting. Because they're making him pass off the ideas as if it was his ideas in the council, right? So they told him, it's just going to be like acting, but you're just going to be saying these lines. So that takes away a little bit of, a little bit, obviously, of the agency, any agency that he might have had in those meetings, in like he's reciting this as if he was acting and, and the way that the actor plays it too is really, stilted.
But, that element of how Strunze convinced him to stand up and convey what they had come up with, was for me one of the best parts of the entire film. The relationship between Strunze and Christian comes through was very authentic. As I said, up until the point where Strunze really gets too greedy.
Yeah.
And turns into a totalitarian.
Yeah, he does. What he does is that he makes him sign a paper where he says that Strunze that the king gives total control to Strunze to sign any decree. He doesn't need the signature of the king anymore. He can leave the room and he can just write the thing, sign it, and it's good.
So up until that moment, I think, and even there's a few things afterwards as well, but up until that moment, I think the relationship between Strunze and Christian is a very true bond.
Yeah.
Strunze, and this is what I liked about this character, he was very smart on how to build the rapport with Christian that he needed.
Yeah.
And he did find a way to connect with Christian and to get the clear moments and the brilliant moments out of the king very often. So by he telling him, you can do it if you think it's like a theater play. I think it was just a smart way to give Christian the self-assurance that he needs, the self-confidence he needed to stand up and go through it, because he knew that up until that moment, Christian was convinced of doing something good and that he could do it. Christian was insecure about his performance. Christian was insecure, like, I cannot do it. I'm too weak or whatever. And in that sense, Strunze acted like his coach.
Yeah.
I love all this. I love all topics on leadership, mentorship, coaching. So I think up until that moment, Strunze acted like a very good coach and mentor for Christian, who had been neglected all of his adulthood. He had been treated like a child.
Yeah.
All his life, he had been infantilized by everybody around him, and Strunze was the first one who took him seriously, who looked at him at eye level and said, "You can do it. You have the ability to do it. Just trust in what you can do well, and you can act very well." So, I think that was like a very positive side of this relationship.
Yeah.
Anyhow, as you mentioned before, Nene, the silver lining gives us, when we look now back to the film and then to today's present, we know that Denmark developed to be one of the most liberal countries in the world. So if we see it from that point of view, we can say they had some kind of happy end.
Yeah, it can happen. But we were also talking about the pendulum of history and the pendulum of of ideas, and you know we see it at the we see it at that very personal level between Strunse and the king, where they do develop this wonderful rapport and relationship, where Strunse is the only person who actually takes the king seriously, who listens to him, who can get to him, who understands that this is a person who is suffering a lot and who needs an ear, who needs a person to take to take him seriously, and he becomes like a father figure for the king. The king had lost his father very young, obviously. He became king at 17, and his mother also did not care for him at all. So he, this was a person.
There was his stepmother.
Yes. So, but his mom, his mother as well. So this was a person who was deeply unloved, and you know, and at that time you had no diagnosis for mental health, or had to deal and you how to deal with any of these things. So he acted up terribly. But if we talk about the pendulum, you know, everybody knows what happened after the French Revolution, when these you know, these ideas of progress, of freedom, liberté, fraternité, égalité, you know, were completely taken to the extreme during the terror. And you know, and then there were, and then there was obviously that was a step back, like huge step back. And then you had Napoleon, and it's just back and forth, back and forth. And in the movie you can see that also, you know, how Strunse was doing some good, but he took it to the extreme as well. Like you said, he became a totalitarian. He became too greedy, and sadly, should we spoil it? Well, he paid with his life.
Yes.
It's extremely sad.
Well, the story is known for people who
Strunse.
It's based on actual facts.
Yeah, so the council, once they realized how much of an influence Strunse had, and that Strunse was actually ruling the kingdom, obviously they used the love affair as the excuse to, you know, to imprison them and condemn them. And Strunse ultimately lost his life because of his ideas and, you know, the way. And then the council took over, and they staged a coup, essentially. And he didn't make it. Caroline made it. She made it out. But she died young.
She died very young, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not portrayed in the film.
It's not shown in the film, but yeah, she died young.
It's not shown in the film. But we have linked some, we will link some interesting resources regarding the historical context of the film and also the historical accuracy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I guess to wrap up.
What this is also mentioned, yeah.
Yeah, to wrap up this topic. It's just, you know, that's the reflection I made. I mean, the people who pay the price, the people who pay the ultimate price for advancing certain ideas. You know, history is littered with all these people who really fought hard. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it was all lost, actually. And in some cases, some battles were won as well.
Yes, and just to finish up, feel like that with a positive and optimistic comment. As I also said at the beginning of this discussion of this topic, it's a pendulum. Yeah, we talked about the pendulum and that we take two steps forwards, one step back, and when people tend to be negative about today's reality. And when I say, okay, everything is so wrong today. There's so many bad things happening all over the world. We as members of society have to take one moment and reflect on this. It swings back and forth. We have come so far already as society. And of course, there's horrible things happening in the world, and there's, a lot of conflicts everywhere. But this is maybe also the price we have to pay to eventually move those two steps forward. Maybe we're doing one step back now, but eventually, throughout the history of humanity, we have this pattern, and we have to stay positive that the steps forward will come. That's what I wanted to add.
Of course. Thank you, Gabi. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
All right, Nene, thank you. This was a very passionate topic to discuss already. As a second topic, I would like to talk to you about the genre vocabulary of this film. I think it wouldn't be quite wrong to say that A Royal Affair is like a textbook period film. For people who love this genre, this is a film that ticks all the points on the checklist. What it is.
Checks all the boxes.
Yes, it checks all the boxes of the list of classic period film. So what do you think about that scene? What are your views as a fan of period films? We must remark, we are not experts, but we are big fans of period films.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this film as a period film classic?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for that question, Gabi. Yes, this movie is very textbook period film. Textbook. And I'm going to say why. First of all, it takes care in recreating the past in the period recreation. Very meticulous. Beautiful to look at. Like, it pays real attention to it. Number two, it tells a historical event. Tells a story of, you know, it combines a historical event with, I mean, it's all historical, but crazily enough, it has a love story in the middle.
Which is actually also part of history.
Exactly, which is actually accurate, historically accurate, but it brings also this common topic in period film, which is, you know, the love story, the meaning of love, the definition of love, the definition of marriage, the function of marriage, which is a very common topic in the movies that we discuss, right? What is the role of marriage? Why are people supposed to love each other? How people viewed love before, how people viewed marriage before. So it also has that element in there. And also for me, I've been thinking a lot about this. And we talked about this when we talked about the El Libertador, which is the Venezuelan film that we discussed last season, that it really meets that very European function as an European film. It fulfills a very European function of creating their own mythology as a nation. I think European nations, and I'm starting to think, I mean, because I don't know enough about Japanese film or Korean film or Indian film. I don't know enough. But I can say that European film uses historical film to build their for nation building, for, you know,
identity.
Identity, yeah. So I think this movie does that. And why is it particularly important in this one? And why do I compare it to El Libertador? is because most historical films really are, you know, British. This is their genre, like this is their specialty, you know. But this is a very important moment in Danish history and main to a Danish film in the Danish language with a filmmaker, Lars von Trier, who's one of the most renowned filmmakers in the country. He was a consultant on the script. So I think he feels that very important role of being part of the memory of a nation. And period film, because of, is trying to kind of build an identity, you know, show the memory of the country to its people. Usually the production has to be, you know, usually takes a lot of money to be able to recreate the past. And the money is reflected in how meticulous the past is recreated. And this movie really, like you said, checks all the boxes, is really lavishly recreated. It's beautiful. And the last thing I'm going to say is that period film borrows from high art and borrows from other arts to demonstrate its prestige. And what do I mean by this? You know, period film usually will borrow from painting, for example, in creating an image of a landscape. It will borrow from classical music by using classical music as the soundtrack of the film. A lot of period film have scenes in the theater. I mean, there's a lot of ways that period film shows that it's prestige, that is elevated, that is supposed to be taken seriously. And this movie does all of those things perfectly.
Thank you, Nini.
That's my answer.
I agree with what you say. And for me, apart from the fact that, of course, visually, it is like perfect. It fits perfectly into this category. There were wicks and candles galore in this film. So many. I really enjoyed this feeling that it takes you back into the time, which we have also discussed in many episodes through our series, that some films don't really manage to transport you back into the time. And I think this one did very well. They really managed to recreate this atmosphere with little details. For me, there were many scenes where you could feel how human the figures were. For example, pretty much at the beginning of the film, we see Caroline traveling in the carriage on her way to meet Christian. And it's a long journey. You see her like during the day, during the evening, with other attire, but always inside the carriage. And at some point she falls asleep and her face is just so human. You see that she's not a queen, that she's not like, you know, like, she's not playing a role in that moment. She just really she loosely falls asleep and leans her head against the window of the carriage. I found her so beautiful. And there was also another scene, two key scenes where I also think, okay, this really takes me really right on the spot on time and place. There was one scene where she is arriving in Copenhagen and she looks outside the window. She's being carried to the palace, and she looks outside the window and sees all the peasants standing along the road, along the street, and all the mud, the poor people with dirty clothes, and the rats walking among the people. And so this is a small detail, but it takes a really, like, it might be a feature film, but we also want to show that it was not all pretty, because we as period film lovers have sometimes a tendency to romanticize, yes, to idealize the past. Yeah, because the dresses were pretty, because the meadows were green, and they would do picnics on a prairie and whatever. We as viewers tend to idealize the past, and by showing those little moments of the dirt, the mud, muddy streets, the rats, I found it really, yeah, really, really clever to point out, okay, this is how it was. So it was for me like a true period film that really takes you into the time. And there's one thing that, of course, I can't really pinpoint, but I saw it in an interview with the actors and the director, where they spoke about the language. I don't speak Danish, and I can't really judge the language, but they did say that some people complained that they didn't use classic old school Danish for this. For me, it sounded beautifully enough.
me too.
So, of course, if you're Danish and you say, okay, back then they didn't speak that much Danish in the royal court. Okay, given. But for me, it was also very beautiful. And also how they, some frames, some scenes, how they framed them, were for me like, yeah, it had the absolute, all the elements, as you mentioned, all the elements, a scene in the theater, a ball, it had a ball, it had a masquerade, with chamber music. Yes, and the costume design was really beautiful. And what I really appreciated this time, and this is also something we have spoken about in the past in other episodes, the makeup was for me a highlight. And it was one of the key elements that allowed me to really deep dive into the time and space and moment. Alicia Vikander has a beautiful face. Beautiful face. And they did her makeup so perfectly for her to look so natural, as we assume it would have been back then, you know, no modern lipstick, no modern hairdos. I think the styling was perfect. Also, the king, Christian, was often portrayed with rings under his eyes, pale, disheveled wig. I think they did such a good job in the entire makeup. Strunse, kind of, also a very authentic face. Not really pepped up, you know? The actor himself, Matt Smith-Kelsen, has a very edgy, face with a very straight jawline. And he was in his mid-40s when he did this film. And they didn't really make him look any younger or anything. He looked like a man who had seen and lived through a lot, like a rough face. So I think everything regarding costume design and makeup, as I said, makeup design, I think they really excelled in this film.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you, and it's boring to agree, but I do agree with you that it was like the perfect balance, because one of the things that we often mention in the podcast is films that look too pretty or too artificial. So again, they weigh a little bit too much. It's like, some movies don't pay a lot of attention to recreating the costumes and the locations, and some pay too much attention, so much attention that you get lost in that instead of the story itself. So it feels artificial. This movie is so perfect that you feel right in the place. It's like everything feels lived in. Mm-hmm. Everything feels real. Everything feels like, yeah, people are sweating under those weeks. People are sweating under those petticoats. People are sweating under those skirts. People are cleaning their hands on aprons. And, you know, everything feels real. Everything feels real. And especially the men. I mean, can we talk about the weeks?
Please, go ahead.
can we talk about the weeks at this moment? I don't know. Maybe it's not the time
yet. Okay. I can see where you're heading. But do you want to wrap?
But yeah. Anyway, it was very beautifully done, but in a real way. It was not excessive. It was not pretty for the sake of being pretty. It's just if pretty because somebody wanted to wear a pretty dress that day. Not pretty for our benefit. Pretty for the benefit of the people who were going to see that dress there in 1766. You know what I mean? It was okay. I think I found a way to say it. It was not pretty for our benefit. It's not pretty for the benefit of the audience. It's pretty for the benefit of the people who was supposed to see it then.
And maybe, Nene, maybe they paid, and then I'm speculating, maybe it does fit with everything that the producers and the director have also mentioned on interviews. However, one thing is for sure, this chapter of history for Denmark is very important. While researching for the film, I learned that this is something that they learn about in school. So everybody in Denmark grows up listening to the story of Christian and Struensee and so on. So I think it was one of the producers who mentioned in one interview saying that the Danish, the filmmakers in Denmark have tried for decades to bring the story to the big screen, to make a big feature film to tell the story, which is very important for them, and that it had only worked then with this production for Royal Affair to finally bring to do it. And so I think they had a big sense of responsibility towards their own country, you know, to say if this plays such a big role in our history as a nation, we have a big duty and a big responsibility to make it right, to make something good out of it. And maybe this is why they really paid attention to make it as authentic and believable and true to the story as possible. I'm speculating, but I do agree. It is one of the most visually one of the most satisfying period.
That's a good word. That's a good word. Satisfying, very satisfying to look at and to be there, because Some movies are too artificial, make it too pretty. Some movies, on the other hand, exaggerate the ugliness and the dirtiness and the grossness. You know, depicting the past as this wild, savage place. And that, you know, but usually that happens with more medieval films, like movies that happen in the medieval period and so on. Not so much 18th century, but this movie is just very, it feels real. And that's just the best gift you can give a period film lover.
Yeah.
That it feels like you're there. Like you can almost smell the wood and the clothes and the places.
It's this scent of humans.
Exactly.
You could really have, there is one scene where one of the mates goes into the chamber of Caroline and she's making the bed and she's tidying up her room and she goes through the sheets. I think this is something that is rarely done. That she goes
rarely
and
wears, done.
And she smells the sheets. Of course, this is a key element to kind of go through the past, bring up the affair, you know, but still it was like a key moment how she lifts the sheets and goes and sniffs on it. I found it like very clear.
Yeah. But you know what? But that scene for the viewer is just a tiny little scene, but very powerful because you never are given the chance to smell anything in these mm-hmm. movies, but as by her doing that, by that gesture,
immediately start imagining.
Immediately you imagine, oh my goodness, how does those sheets mm-hmm. feel in my hands and in mm-hmm. my nose, and what does it smell like? Mm-hmm. It was very powerful. Mm-hmm.
It was very
you
powerful.
Are so right. Anyway, that was very good, Gabby. Should we move on to our next section of the podcast?
Yes, go ahead.
So we can move on to our favorite segment of the episode, which is the Wicks and Candles quiz. And it consists of four questions. And I'm going to be asking Gabby the questions. So let's start with the first one. So, Gabby, what is your sweaty wig? One thing you didn't like about the movie.
Okay. I might make myself unpopular by this. But my sweaty wig was indeed the love story between Caroline and Johan. The way they portrayed it was, visually beautiful, but it gave me as a viewer very little material to believe why they fell in love for each other. There were just like three key scenes where they had a special moment together alone. And after those three key moments, they ended up in bed and they were madly in love with each other. So the first moment is where Caroline is in his room and discovers that he has all these books about the Enlightenment. And so she kind of understands, okay, this guy is kind of smart and we have something in common. So that's key. The first moment, which is, okay, this guy might be interesting. The second scene, if I'm not mistaken, is where she meets him in the park and she starts the conversation about, so you think these thoughts of freedom and whatever. So they have this brief conversation about these ideas, the Enlightenment ideas. And then there's the dancing scene at the masquerade. And that's it. And it was a beautiful scene, I have to admit. The scene of Caroline and Johan dancing on the ball is very beautiful because they as soon as they start dancing, at some point they make it in slow motion. They dance in slow motion. They also tone down the music. And you only hear the earrings of Caroline tingling softly and the touch of their hands and so on. So it's a beautifully made scene, how they dance and how they look at each other and how they get closer. And then as soon as this moment, the magic of this moment is over, then the music in the background gets louder again and the pace is real again. Beautifully done. But for me, as a viewer, it was like, okay, so it took you only like one conversation and one dancing moment to absolutely fall in love with this man. I don't know. It was not quite believable for me. And I read the Roger Ebert critic review on this.
Oh, really?
Is researching, and he said something that stuck with me, and I'm going to quote Roger Ebert on this.
Oh my goodness, go ahead. I love him and miss him a lot.
Yes. He said, they were more in love with what they were doing than with each other. And then pretty much summarizes.
Can you please repeat again?
They were more in love with what they were doing than with each other.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
That was my sweaty week.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Oh, my goodness. That's great.
Even with a quote.
My goodness. I don't have a quote.
It's okay, Nene. You don't have to.
But you know what? Roger Ebert, he's still one of my favorite movie critics. He wrote beautifully. And yeah, I will agree with that assertion very much. And you know what? It's okay. if they were more in love with their ideas than each other. I mean, they, especially Caroline, she was not loved. Mm-hmm. She was treated, actually very badly mm-hmm. treated by Christian. So I can see how she would be desperate for any connection, any intellectual connection, any tenderness mm. at all. So you can see that on that level. And well, and if they were more in love with their ideas,
so be it.
So what, so what? The love stories can come in all shapes and forms and. I love that they were in love with ideas.
Okay.
Actually.
That's how I also took it for me, that to kind of, okay, what did it come across like this for me? Maybe because, of course, she was projecting all what she was yearning for. She projected on Johan, So she was very young and she had already realized that she was stuck with this was her destiny. This would have been her entire life, being unloved and being trapped with a person she doesn't love for forever, and not getting to know real love. So she projected maybe all this yearning for a connection, for love, for passion, for tenderness, as you say, on Johan, So, yeah, that was my story week. How about yours, Nene?
I love this movie so much that I actually didn't think of any sweaty wig. So I have to come up with one on the spot. I'm going to say, even though he won the award at the Berlinale, I'm not going to criticize the actor. I'm just going to talk about this character, the king, Christian. It's not a sweaty wig. I guess it's just he saddens me so much. This character is so painful to watch. It's a very painful character to see suffer. Yeah, he was a king. I understand. He was privileged. A white Danish dude with a kingdom. I understand. But God, he was so ill and he was so unhappy. And he just as a human being, he suffered so much. He was so unloved as well. He was a debauch as well. He was not a saint. He was not just a victim. He also deeply mistreated Caroline, but he also lived a life of pleasure. An excess. So this character is quite unsavory to look at and quite sad to look at. And it's not a sweaty wig, but I guess it's a part of the movie that made me really, and I think I guess that's the point, uncomfortable, very sad. Still, this guy was not nice at the same time. It was really terrible too.
He was pretty bit. I read that most likely his tutor in real life, that he mistreated him badly in his childhood.
So that in real life, the king was badly mistreated by traumatized. Mm-hmm. Abused.
Oh my gosh!
Severely abused tutor. So I will say that. Yeah, so Mikkel Folsgaard, the actor who played Christian, I think he conveyed this very flawed, not lovable person, but you can still feel some sympathy for him. Okay, perfect. So let's go to the next question. What is your shining candle? One thing you love about the movie?
Well, there were many beautiful things in the movie. I chose for me the key bonding moments between Johan and Christian. For me, those were like among all this brutality that is portrayed, all the, as you said, all the sadness that you feel watching Christian being abused, manipulated, infantilized, and so on. The few moments where he is treated as a human, as a human being, as a clever, good-hearted human being by Johann, were for me like those drops of honey in the story. There's one scene where they're somewhere outside. They're on a, it's a beautiful summer day, and they're outside, and Caroline is watching them. They're somehow on a prairie near a river, and she watches the two of them hanging out. And she sees them like sitting down, leaning against a tree, with her pants rolled up to their knees and barefoot, just like sitting together and chatting. It's a beautiful scene. There's the scene of Christian in the bathtub where Johann tells him, you can do it. When he says, if you can go to the council and, give your speech and bring up our ideas as law. And Christian was doubting so much. And this moment where he's just like looking, you know, just staring ahead and thinking and he listening to what Johann is telling him. And then looking back at Johann, and he's so clear in that moment. He's so clear. He's like, you're right. I can do this, you know, and you see what positive effect Johann had in Christian and Christian's self-confidence. And the third key moment that I found very compelling and very touching between the two of them is pretty much towards the end of the film, where the entire thing with the affair has come up. There's a coup already going on. And Christian, of course, feels betrayed by his friend, Johann. They had become very good friends up until that moment. And they meet again in the turmoil of events, and they hug as friends. And Johann tells him, I did lie to you. I did lie to you. And Christian says, okay, I don't want to hear about it. Because in that moment, his friendship with Johann and what Johann had done for him was more important to him. And they hug very dearly. So the key moments this constellation, Johann and Christian, were for me very beautiful, very touching. And I agree with you that his character was difficult to swallow and digest. There was a lot of moments that make you, as you said, uncomfortable. It's a tough topic. It's mental illness. It's a tough topic. So it is quite uncomfortable. So I totally agree that this actor, Mikkel Fosgaard, definitely deserved acknowledgement for his role, because he was absolutely outstanding. That was my shining candle.
Excellent. You provided examples. You bucket up your argument. I
mean, you can say what was your shining candle.
Can I say? That was amazing, Gabby. Thank you very much. And you are right. Some of those were of the most moving moments of the movie, and that, you know, what that shows, how well written that script was. Mm-hmm. Because it made space for those moments. It made space to clarify, to make sure we understand the complexity of that relationship by showing us those very important moments throughout the movie. Which you pointed out. My shining candle, and I didn't think of these ones before, so I'm just going to go with my instinct here, and I think it's the cinematography of this movie. I was just, from the beginning to the end, there are interspersed throughout the movie, these outdoor scenes. Cinematography refers to both outside, indoors, outdoors, you know, the light, what type of camera, all of that. But there's a few outdoor scenes that are absolutely breathtaking in this movie. From the very beginning, when we see Caroline still in England, collecting flowers, to the moment she arrives in Copenhagen. And actually this scene that I really love, that looked like a painting, was mm-hmm. actually built with special effects, where they show a big ship, a harbor, but that is just like an astonishing image. But also, there's one particular scene that is the one that sticks in my mind. That is when, actually, that could be one of the scenes that shows Johan mm-hmm. and Caroline falling in love. They go riding. They go horseback riding. And Caroline says, I found it really uncomfortable. And he says, oh, because you're doing side saddle. So she goes horseback riding with the proper, you know, seating, like with the both legs on their side, and they go back horseback riding, and it's obviously shot in the most luscious green meadows, and they're just going through the fields, and then it starts raining, and they take refuge under this big huge tree. So big that they can take refuge under it, right? And it's raining, and they're just under the tree, not getting wet. But Caroline, she goes to the edge of the tree, and he starts talking to her. You're gonna get wet, and she says, "Shh, shh." She says, "Shh, shh." It reminds me of home, and she takes her hand, and she gets rain in her hand a little bit, and the light, the sound. This is not cinematography because the sound is included here, but this whole scene is spectacular in making you feel that this tree that you're looking at, this is 1768 or whatever. This is not in the 21st century. Truly just beautiful, a beautifully constructed scene for sure, using all the tools that movies give you to be able to tell a story, the sound, the shot, you know, the shot of her. I love that scene because, you know, nature in period films is very important because it shows an idealized past where civilization has not yet, you know, destroyed everything. So I think that's the function of a lot of these scenes. This is one of them, and it's absolutely perfect. But all of the outdoor scenes are similar. In fact, even better than that scene is when they're coming back from riding, and the weather is like foggy, and they're coming down this little pathway, and then they see something horrific in the distance, which is this man who has been tortured by his owner in a wooden horse. Like, it's a torture tool. And it's a horrific scene because they realize what's actually happening in, you know, to the peasants. But also the light in this scene is sublime. The green of the field, the foggy, you know, the rain, that the mist of the rain that's still in the air. You can smell this place. Just gorgeous. So that's my shining candle. There you go.
It's beautiful, Nene. Thank you for bringing up this scene because it was really, really beautiful. And what you just mentioned, you can smell the rain in your head when she's standing there and touching. Because she takes the moment to what you mentioned, that she hushes Johan. It gives you as a viewer also the moment to stay quiet and to listen and to imagine how it must have felt, sounded, and smelled.
Very beautiful. Well done.
Very beautiful, Nene.
Okay. All right, let's go to our third question. We're taking so long here, but anyway. So our third question is, a stolen costume.
Very fast, Nene. I will keep the mask that Caroline is holding during the masked ball. was a beautiful mask with a lot of feathers, and he has like a golden stick to hold. And I guess I would just, you know, just to feel gracious and fancy, I would like to keep that mask and walk around my house, putting that mask in front of my face and greet myself in the mirror, because I think it was just beautiful and so delicate.
Yeah, that is, thank you. That's a remarkable mask.
Yes. How about you, Nene? Which piece of costume or prop would you like to keep?
The you know, I've been on a male costume trend lately, but I was really in love with the women's costumes in this movie. Everything was so impeccable. The little capes behind the dress. I mean, just every fabric, every piece of fabric, every piece of tulle and the edge. It was just, delicious. However, there was no piece that I said, I want that. Nothing. I don't know why. I guess the story really, you know what? I think this is what happens when you create something so real that you are really immersed in the story itself without paying attention to the, you know, the clothing itself was not attracting mm-hmm. attention to itself. It was just, mm-hmm. it was just functioning within the story. And because of that reason, I think nothing really stood out. Perhaps those earrings that you mentioned. I was looking at those earrings, and she's also wearing these mm-hmm. Bracelets that we briefly see. And it's a very classic 18th century bracelet, because he has like this little...
Camafeo.
But what is the word in English? I don't know. It's just a very classic 18th century bracelet with...
I'm depressed with... I don't know. Is it a locket? I don't know if it's
a locket. Like a locket. Yeah, kind of like a locket, but you only briefly see it.
Mm. But Nene, I agree. Just to comment on your shining candle, I have to admit that I also struggle to find piece of costume or prop, because... And I agree with you. Maybe this is exactly the reason. And this is maybe why we think that we had this feeling, this... film is the perfect period film mm-hmm. movie mm-hmm. because it doesn't distract you from paying attention to what's really happening to the story. I found that a very, very, very valid comment. I agree 200%.
But I think that I think now is the time to talk about the wigs in this movie.
Go ahead.
Because the wigs did distract me a tiny bit, not a huge lot, not a lot. But at the very, very, very beginning, when I saw the first white wigs, I was like, wow, these are very, what word can I use? Fluffy wigs? Gabby, they are so fluffy. Do you see how fluffy they look? Like cotton.
They look like cotton. I love that.
Fluffy. And I was like, what kind of wigs are these? They were not your classical wigs from movies. They look very fluffy. They look more artificial. They didn't look as heavy. And I was just like, who made the choice? Who made the call for these wigs? These were not... You know how when we watch Chevalier, those were the most impeccable wigs we have ever seen. Like, that was a choice, obviously, how meticulous, how like they were perfect, not a hair out. The wigs were super neat. These wigs are the opposite, very fluffy. They look like cotton and messy. You can see the hairline of people. And for both men and women.
Mm-hmm.
Caroline never wears a wig, I don't think. And Johan either, because mm-hmm. you know, they are people of the Enlightenment. They mm-hmm. they are leaving behind this kind of fashion. So those wigs were particularly interesting to me. They were very fluffy.
And again, was definitely more authentic than the wigs in Chevalier. The wigs in Chevalier were visually perfect and beautiful, but I think Fluffy would have been more real with hair sticking out. This is something they wore day in, day out, every day. And of course, they were remade. They were, you know, styled every once in a while and taken care of. But of course, that there's like hairs coming out. This is natural.
But you know what? There's always, you know, all of the movies with wigs, there's always a little bit, you know, the wigs are a little unmade and all that. But go back and watch the very beginning, the very wig. This, it's like there's a fluffiness in them that is very unusual.
I agree. I love the association of the fluffy wigs with cotton candy. It's like beautiful.
That was the stolen costume or prop. So let's go to the last question in the quiz. So Gabby, if given the chance, would you time travel to the period? Yes, no, and why?
I wrote a nah in my book.
Okay.
I was torn how to decide, because I didn't want to fall in the trap of idealizing the time. It's way back. You know, we have spoken about different periods in history through our series of podcasts. And there's periods by now, after watching so many period films, by now are definitely more appealing to me to time travel, whereas this time has become tough for me to imagine to go back, even though I know as the conditions we in the Wicks and Candles podcast put for the time travel, it is a return ticket. You're only there temporarily and you have the chance to come back. Even though that, I think there were such tough times. If you were not in a royal court, you were in a city where it was filthy and stinky and dirty and tough. You would sweat a lot on a lot of dresses and wigs and so on. It would be maybe interesting to be back then and there during the time where Johan and Christian managed to pass on these laws, to see, maybe to take a peek on what is this causing among the people. That would have been interesting, that short time of period where they managed to implement most of those laws, even though it most likely was very chaotic.
Yeah.
It's very chaotic, maybe, because it was too avant-garde. So I decided for no, I wouldn't go back. How about you, Nin?
I'm terrible. I'm so terrible. You sent me to the 18th century, and I don't know why, but I will understand. Maybe on season 10 of this podcast, I will have found out the reason why the 18th century has such a hold on my imagination. I really like the costumes. I really like the people dressed at the time. I really love that aesthetic for some reason. But like always, we fall into this discussion. Like, who would I be in then? You see the conditions of the peasants. It was the lowest of the low. And in many ways, if you think of Denmark, and they talk about this, and we mention it, was behind the times, even comparing to other European countries at the time. So for these peasants, it was not really 1766. It was probably, you know, they were still living in the same way, exactly same conditions, exactly same way that they were living, you know, 50 years back or 80 years back. Like, for them, progress probably was super slow, even slower, because they didn't have access to all the, you know, things that you might have at a palace. The new technologies that you might have if you're a merchant in your house, whatever. But I don't know. At the same time, you know, Gabby, the rise of ideas. I think this is the appeal that these ideas were actually making their way. through this darkness. Mm. I will go.
You'll go.
I will go. I will probably go back like day two. Especially rainy Copenhagen looks so not hospitable. But I will still go.
Very good, very brave. Maybe I'm being too rational in my answer.
No, you're being complete. No, that's absolutely fine. I think I just want to look at inside a window. I don't know why. I want to look at a printing press where they're printing these pamphlets with information for people with new ideas. I don't know what it is about it. Maybe I am from that time.
Who knows?
Maybe I live there already and I just want to go back.
You want to go back. We have talked about this offline.
Oh, yes, we have.
So yeah. Very beautiful.
So I will go. Okay, perfect. So Gabby, let's wrap up our discussion. Let's do our wicks and candles rating. So our candle wicks and candles rating is from 1 to 10. 1 is a very sweaty wick and 10 is all the wicks and candles. So Gabby, how many wicks and candles do you give A Royal Affair?
Oh, I am struggling. I am struggling. Technically, for all the hard facts, it's a 10. On the soft facts, a bit lower. So I'm going to go for an 8. I'm going to go for an 8 because it is a very well told story. It was a very well made film. As you mentioned, the script was excellent, and this is also why they also got an award for that. Mm-hmm. But as I said, the love story turned me off a little bit, and also the development of Johan, which is a very human thing, you know, because he got so close to power that he turned into what he turned to, you know, that he had this temptation of taking over full power. The transition was not made very clear. You know, that you are, as a viewer, you are following Johan and his ideas, and you, of course, you're happy and you're like, okay, he's a cool alternative guy with a lot of modern ideas. And then to see suddenly how he turns into this totalitarian, you know, the jump from cool Johan to crass Johan was not nuanced, was not really shown, didn't give you the space to follow his, you know, his transformation. So maybe that I would put as a minus point. How about you, Nini?
Very good. I was thinking of an 8 as well, and it's hard to explain because the movie is kind of impeccable. And there's many beautiful things, but yeah, perhaps also as well, similar to you, some of those character development moments that were not quite there. I think an 8 is very appropriate for this movie because technically it's kind of perfect. And it feels beautiful. But at the end, I don't know if I'm rating it with my heart more than my mind. I was so sad. Maybe
it was so sad.
I think maybe that's what I think that's, in all fairness, I think I'm rating with my heart and not my mind. I was just too sad when it ended. I was just left with this pain of history feeling. And like nobody wins really. I mean,
nobody wins. Even though I follow you, Nene. Even though the last scene, and this is again another spoiler, the last scene is the children of Christian and Caroline, Frederick and Louisa, coming into the chamber of the king, who's sitting on the edge of the bed with the back to the camera. And Louisa opens a window, and then they both sit next to the father, and there's a text blended in telling how it really went on for Denmark. And there they explained that the son of Caroline Christian took over power, became a king eventually, and he reigned for a very long time, and he re-implemented many of the ideas and on the work that Johan and Christian and somehow Caroline had achieved on their time. And even though the scene is really so sad, because it is sad, you know, the king is like, he has like, he's, you see him from the back and he's like sitting with a launching bag, you know, like defeated. He has a defeated image, and the kids are there, and just, you feel like, you feel loneliness. Still, reading that text on top of that image gives you like, so at the end, there is a happy end. Because not too long after those moments, not too long afterwards, they still managed to move forward, to take those two steps forward, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a bittersweet. Sure. It's a bittersweet image.
It's bittersweet. It's bittersweet. I think that scene, even though we have the text telling us, you know, eventually the next king, the song, he reigned, implemented, and, you know, that is one of the few times where I feel that's one of the few scenes in any period film movie that make me feel a little afraid of the past. That if you tell me you want to go back to that room, I will say no immediately. Like, it makes me feel really
apprehensive.
Yeah, or, you know, there's a, I do not like the recent past. Like, I always say I don't feel nostalgia. Like, I don't like my past. I don't think of my childhood. I want to go back to it. I don't think of the 70s, the 80s. I do not ever want to see those decades again, or the 90s. Please never take me back to those times. Because I feel kind of gross. I feel like I cannot even bear it to even think of going back to that. It's so uncomfortable to me. So that one scene, just that one, is one of the few period, you know, past, with, you know, well in the past scenes that make me feel like I would not want to be in that place.
In that melancholy.
In the melancholy. Yeah, there's a profound melancholy there. And maybe the conclusion of this is that, you know, we suffer from the people, you know, obviously people in the past were happy. People lived happy lives. People felt happiness. But I think we also suffer a lot for how, you know, people were born at the wrong time as well. And the sadness of those lives. You know, just the individual sad lives.
Yeah, certain destinies, yeah.
Yeah, the destinies of certain people. I guess that's the feeling I get.
Yes. Anyway.
Anyway. And we're on a melancholy note, but that is the discussion. Thank you so much, Gabby, for talking to me about this movie.
Thank you, Nene, for the chance to go through it in such detail. I enjoyed it a whole lot.
And we finally did it. It's been on our list for such a long time.
Yes, it was a delight.
Yeah, this is one I will watch again. I like this movie a lot. Anyway, well, thank you everybody for listening. And yeah, see you next time.
Thank you for listening. And stay tuned. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Books and Candles is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
So go ahead and subscribe and follow us on Instagram @Books and Candles. Thanks for listening and see you next time.